Awesome.
Hi, everybody. That's fantastic. Great to see you guys.
Okay, Brian, to start out, could we just talk a little bit about the title of the book and what We Make the Road by Walking, what you envisioned with that title and what it actually means?
Sure. Well, just by way of background, actually, if you put me on mute when I'm talking, let's see, or put your mic on mute, I'm getting an echo, so that'll help me. Can you do that? And I'll try to just talk for a minute or two, so then you can unmute. Do you have a little mute button down at the bottom of your picture? There should be a microphone, and if you click that, it should mute it. Good, thanks, perfect. So I originally encountered that title through a book by a Brazilian educator named Paulo Freire, and it turns out that it came from a Spanish poet named Antonio Machado. But to me, it's a beautiful image for what it means to venture out in faith when you're going out beyond where the road ends. And the image struck me as important because the tradition of our faith, it's as if that tradition has brought us up to a certain point right now. And here we stand, and before us, if the tradition is going to continue, we're going to have to extend the tradition. So the road, we're not walking a road that's already completed and we just follow it. We actually, as we move into the future, keep extending the road farther and farther into the future. So that, when I wanted to write a book that was an overview of the biblical story, very often as we look back, we assume that everybody in the Bible had the Bible, but they didn't. Everybody in biblical times, they didn't have the Bible. So their journey was always a journey of faith. And I think that helps us to remember that the journey of faith, it isn't just repeating what's been said. It involves taking everything we've learned from the past and now continuing to walk into the future. I hope that makes a little bit of sense. Feel free to follow up on that if you want.
Yeah. So one of the things I was thinking of and the phrase that came to mind when you said that was the idea of a living tradition.
Yes.
So not something that's kind of bound in the past, but something that's alive and still moving and vibrant and changing. Could you talk a little bit about, in one of your books, A New Kind of Christianity, which was absolutely amazing, you talk about the idea of reading the Bible as a constitution versus a library.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Well, there's a lot I could say about that, but and I'm sure we have people from a lot of different religious backgrounds in the room. I grew up Protestant, and you know, when you grow up something, you just think that's normal, and why is everybody else different? I ended up marrying a Catholic girl, and one of the differences between Catholics and Protestants is that Catholics say the Bible has authority because the church gives it authority. And Protestants say the church has authority because the Bible gives it authority. So the primary locus of authority for Protestants has always been in the Bible. But one of our huge challenges is how do we use the Bible? How does the Bible work as our authority? The word that's very important in the Bible itself is the word inspiration. And there's a beautiful passage in the New Testament in 2 Timothy that says, all scripture is inspired by God and is profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, and training in righteousness. So inspiration has to do with God breathing into the text to help us know what's true, be corrected when we're wrong, and be set on the right path and be able to keep doing good things on the right path. That little verse ends up, so that the people of God can be equipped for every good work. So the real purpose of it is to put us to work. What I think has happened in Protestant history is that something kind of interesting. If you think back in our history, Protestants made the audacious claim that the church could exist without a pope. And what they said is the Bible gives us the authority so we can be church without a pope. In government, Americans and increasing numbers of countries around the world said, we can be a nation without a king. And the way we functioned without a king was to have a constitution. So I think naturally what happened in a lot of people's minds is we started to read the Bible as if it were our constitution. And that's certainly the way I was trained. And probably a lot of us in the room were trained. We would kind of quote chapter and verse the way a lawyer might quote Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 2, you know, point 1. And that's the way I was trained. It's actually the way I preached for a lot of years when I was a preacher. But as time's gone on, I've come to see that that's not the best category for the Bible. You know, there weren't constitutions back in biblical times. And the Bible is something a lot more interesting than that. So my proposal is that the Bible is actually more like a library. And in that library, we have documents from across history. And if we study those documents and read those stories, not putting them in the category of a constitution, but let them work the way stories worked in the ancient world, then we will be inspired and we'll be equipped for good works, like 2 Timothy chapter 3 says. But it will happen more the way we're inspired and equipped by reading by going to the library and reading a whole bunch of books than by the way we would be inspired by having a constitution that we try to enforce, you know, like as we would in a court or a Congress, something like that. I'll be interested to hear from you all how you feel that's going as you give yourselves the opportunity to try to engage with the Bible as a library in that way. I think you're in chapter 5. When you get to chapter 13, that will really, that'll be the chapter where I really will have you engage with that idea of a library.
Well, I was reading in Pete Enns's new book.
Yes.
The Bible Tells Me So. And he says in that book that the problem isn't the Bible. The problem is we try to make the Bible do all sorts of things the Bible isn't set up to do.
Yes.
So, let's open it up to you guys now. Who has a question? Don't stampede the mic all at once. But come on up, just tell Brian who you are, and then ask your question.
You know what I always like to say? If anybody's nervous about asking the first question, we'll just skip that and go to the second, so it'll be a lot easier.
Hello, Brian. How are you tonight? I'm Jim Green.
Hi, Jim. Nice to meet you.
Hey, it's good to be with you tonight. Thanks for taking your time. Hey, the question that I have is a pretty simple question. The quest for aliveness explains so much of what we do in our everyday lives. Can you further explain to us how we keep that theme moving forward in our everyday lives in this negative and challenging world that we live in every day? Tell us how. Thank you.
That's
very
a great
much.
Question. Jim, the first thing I would say is I think you're very wise to realize that it doesn't happen automatically, and there's a lot of things that happen that kick the stuffing out of us, and we get distracted from aliveness very, very easily. I'm going to guess that in maybe at least half of the people in the room there and in your life right at this moment, you know, at any given moment, a big percentage of us have some tough things going on. Stresses at work, challenges in your family, financial problems, medical problems. And very often we get so wrapped up in the problems. Our brain starts to feel like a little hamster running around, a little rat running around in those wheels. And we can just sort of forget that the sun is still shining out there and the wind is still blowing and the grass is still green and food is still on the table, you know? And so the first thing I would say, Jim, is just remembering that it's easy to go on autopilot and forget that we're actually alive and being given another day, the great gift of another day. Very often, you know, a tragedy comes. If you're a man, maybe your wife gets a scary test result back from the doctor, and you think, oh no, you know, is this breast cancer? And you might have been having a big fight with your wife, or you might have been taking your wife for granted for weeks, and then that test comes, and suddenly you realize how precious she is. And you know, it often takes a tragedy to wake us up to what a gift, to things that we've been completely taking for granted. And that's why I think one of the most important spiritual practices is gratitude, because the practice of gratitude teaches us to start paying attention to what we already have. There's a brilliant Catholic philosopher named Joseph Pieper, and he was a philosopher of happiness. And he said that happiness doesn't consist in having. Happiness consists in appreciating what you have. So to me, the first thing that comes to my mind in response to your great question is that we should just monitor, you know, and be aware that we can go on autopilot and be half alive. And second, it's the wonderful, wonderful practice of gratitude. You'll actually come to that in a chapter later in the book. It is just extremely, extremely important. One last thing I'll say about that question, Jim, is that I think it's good to remember that every single day, or at least Monday through Friday, there are people who wake up and make hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to convince you that your life isn't worth anything unless you have a new car, or your life isn't worth anything unless you have a new pair of shoes or that new shirt or some new hairstyle, right? And because in many ways, our economy runs on making people unhappy. Everything you have doesn't mean anything if you don't have the new iPhone. And so if we could just realize that we live in an economy and a culture, in a whole way of life that robs us of appreciation and gratitude, I think that helps us realize what a radical thing it is when, for example, in Psalm 92, it says, "It is good to give thanks to the Lord and to sing praises to your name, O Most High." It's a good thing for God. I'm sure it's gratifying for God that we do that, but it's really good for us. It's good for us to cultivate gratitude.
All right. Who's next? That was a great second question, Jim.
Hello, sir. I'm Gail Smirdick, and I've been attending here at the church for about 7 years now.
Hi, Gail.
I have been leafing through and looking ahead, and I see that you do address people's spiritual gifts and that they should seek what their gifts are. Do you also encourage people to see where they can serve in their local body? Because it's probably a recurring problem that, you know, there's a nucleus that kind of takes care of everything at the church, when really
yes,
God has equipped the whole body to fill those needs, but they're not seeking it to fill those positions. And therefore, they are missing the blessing of aliveness, because to serve and give to people and share what God has given you gives you such joy.
You sound like you know what you're talking about there, Gail. Well, first of all, Gail, you are so right, and I'm really glad you bring that up. And you're bringing back to my mind, you know, I was a pastor for 24 years, and how people who understood that value of service, how precious they were, and how the church really depended on them. You're going to come to a chapter later in the book, in near the end of the book, that's about service. It's about service. And I think you'll be able to talk a lot about your own experience in that chapter. I think about a poem that my pastor, now I attend a church, and I'm not a pastor anymore. And my pastor has a poem he likes to recite. "I slept and dreamed that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life is service. I served and learned that service is joy. Isn't that great? I slept and dreamed that life was joy. I woke and saw that life is service. I served and discovered that service is joy. And this is one of the great surprises in life. It really goes back to Jim's question as well. If gratitude is one of the real keys to aliveness, ironically, sincere service is too. That's especially important for people who are always feeling like, why doesn't somebody do this for me? Why doesn't somebody do that for me? Why doesn't somebody do something else for me? And when we are always noticing what others aren't doing for us, that's a great way to make us depressed and angry and critical. But when we then say, well, what could I do for somebody else? That then we discover, like that poem says, that that service is joy. The only other thing I think I would say about your question, Gail, is that, and this might surprise you that I'll say this, but I think we have, you know, there's a saying that 20% of the people in the church do 80% of the work. And here's what I think. I wish that 30% of the people in the church could do 100% of the work. And then the other 70% could be more fully equipped to do their work outside the church, if you see what I'm saying. I mean, probably it's good for everybody to serve in some way. But I think we have to rediscover this reality too, that some people, there might be some teachers in the room, and you are actually serving God by being a teacher. And we might have some police officers in the room. You're serving God by being a police officer. Could you all raise your hands? How many of you are mothers? Could all the mothers in the room raise your hand? Okay, I know that you're doing God's work, right? Fathers, you could raise your hand. You're doing God's work as mothers and fathers. So here's what I want to offer you a little distinction, and here it is. There's church work, which is really important. That's the work of teaching Sunday school and setting up chairs and preaching sermons and singing in the worship team and serving on committees and taking care of the budget and giving in the offering, which is really important. And all of that's really, really important. But there's also the work of the church. And the work of the church is done by people who love their neighbors, by people who stop at the side of the road and help somebody else out, by people who do a good job in their work every week, working joyfully and their job to the Lord, and sharing their faith and living their faith with others. So all that's to say, if we could really understand that what happens to keep the church going is really important, but it's like it's what makes possible the other really exciting work of the church out in the world at large.
Yeah, something Gail didn't tell you is that she is one of those people who really serves our church well. She's one of our elders. She's a volunteer. She's our resident artist as well. She does some pretty amazing things. Who's next?
I'm not surprised, because anyone who would ask a question like that, you know, they know about the joy of service. So that's beautiful. Thanks, Gail.
Who's next?
Hi, Brian.
Good to see you. Hi, what's your name?
Dennis Kincaid. I've been here for years now. This sort of goes along with the theme of aliveness. A couple of questions that you bring up. Not so much in this church, thankfully, because of the leadership we have, but it's sort of just ingrained into us. This focus on heaven, of getting to heaven as a point of being a Christian and all, or a fear of hell for that matter. Do you feel that when we get too focused on that, it really takes away from being truly alive in this life?
Yeah. Boy, you said your name is Dennis?
Yeah.
Dennis, really, really great question. In fact, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, Dennis. You know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but I've been a pastor for a long time. before I realize something that's really, really obvious. And here it is. Hell is never mentioned in the Old Testament. Now, if you have a King James Bible, it is, but everybody agrees it's a bad translation. There's a word in the Old Testament called Sheol, but Sheol just means the grave or the place of the dead. And it's pretty clear when you really, you know, do a lot of background research that what you see in the Old Testament, you really don't see much interest in the afterlife at all. And that develops later in Jewish history. It actually really enters Jewish history in the period between the book of Malachi and the book of Matthew, a period of 400 years or so. And I believe in an afterlife. I believe Jesus believed in an afterlife. But it's interesting that the whole Old Testament made sense to the people without believing in an afterlife. You might say, why didn't they believe in an afterlife? And this is just a tangent. But it's interesting when you think about how the afterlife was used in the ancient world. Basically, people were told, if you don't behave, and if you don't be a good slave, if you don't do what Pharaoh tells you to do, if you don't tell what the king tells you to do, then you'll go to hell. And you may have heard that in Egypt, the only way you could have an afterlife that was good was if you did exactly what the king and the nobles and the rich people wanted. And in fact, in some cases, you would be buried alive with a powerful person who was your employer in hopes that you would sort of go in on the train into the afterlife. So the afterlife was used in a lot of bad ways. In that way, I'm not surprised that the ancient Hebrews didn't want to talk about it that much because they saw how it was used in such bad ways. And then the subject develops, and you're actually going to come to a chapter about this next spring. But the theme develops, and then Jesus, I think, does some amazing twists on it. Just as an example, he tells a story about when the nations will be brought before God and judged. By the way, in his mind, this isn't about how individuals are, but it's actually about how the Gentile nations, the people of the world, come before God, and God says, you can come into the joy of my kingdom. You can come into the joy of eternal life. And people say, well, that's good. You know why? They expect to hear, because you were circumcised and you kept the Ten Commandments and you gave a lot of money to the synagogue and so on and so forth. But then Jesus turns at it and he says, because I was hungry and sick and naked and in prison, and you were good to me. And then they think, when did we ever see that happen? We never saw. And of course, then he says, as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. So it's fascinating that Jesus then uses the afterlife as a reason to motivate people for how they're going to live their life here and now. I'll tell you one of the really, it's so obvious, but I can't believe it took me this long to see it. In Matthew, there was a beautiful, obvious verse in the Lord's Prayer that says this: not our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. May we go to your kingdom when we die. That's not what it says. It's our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. May your kingdom come. May your will be done here on earth as it is in heaven. And so it's so interesting that prayer really brings the focus downward to this earth, that's really the focus. I do think Jesus uses the afterlife as a motivation, but he uses it as a motivation so that we will live well and serve well in this life. So that's the idea there.
Great. Who's next? And if you have a question about a question, that's good too.
Hi, everyone, sir. My name is Bob Wilson. My question is a little bit different from the others. Doing some research about you and what have you, you've mentioned the New Christianity, and I believe, Josh, you mentioned about a book earlier, mm-hmm. and I've been reading that on and off. I was wondering if you would maybe expound on the new emergence of the New Christianity.
Yeah. Your name is Bob, is that right? Well, Bob, here's, you know, I think the Christian faith has always been a living tradition. And so I think it's always changing and it's always learning new things. So you could go back and if you study, for example, in the Middle Ages, you know, things got to a pretty bad place. There was terrible things going on, a lot of corruption in the clergy and so on. And then a guy named St. Francis came along, and St. Francis modeled this very different understanding, this very different way of life. He presented a new kind of Christianity back in the 13th century. And then a lot of us would know a name like Martin Luther or Menno Simons or John Wesley, other leaders who came up in church history. And each of them offered a new understanding, a new form, a new way of living the Christian faith in their day. And I think in our day, this has been kind of emerging for a long time. And I'll just maybe give a couple examples of things in our lifetime. When I was a boy, and any of you who are my age or older, I'm 58. I know I don't look a day over 68, but I'm 58. And when I was a boy on Saturday afternoons, there were black and white movies. How many of you remember Saturday afternoon movies on TV? Some of you old timers do. And of course, the movies were all black and white back then, but they would show movies on TV. And very often on a Saturday afternoon, you would see a movie where a man whacked a woman. And it wasn't a bad guy who whacked a woman. It was the hero who slapped a woman or pushed a woman around. The closest we ever see to that, but most of those movies we don't show anymore because they're offensive to people. The closest we see, next time if you, this Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life comes along. And there's one scene where I forgot the main character's name, but he's with his girlfriend, or it might be his wife by that point, and he shakes her. And I know even when I see that, it's a little bit jarring because, we just don't see domestic violence, portrayed by good people in movies anymore. And what we'd have to say is, well, how did that change? And the reason it changed, first, there was a long period of time where a person could be considered a good Christian. A man could be considered a good Christian who roughed up his wife. It was acceptable. Some of you in the room might remember a time when white people, you could be a good white Christian and still say racist things about black people. That wasn't that long ago. I went to a church that was like that as a boy. So you realize that there have been changes going on always, and in our lifetime, there have been changes going on. And that all is part, I think, evidence of some kind of emergence that's happening. I'll tell you two people who played a big role in my thinking and helping me see that something new was going on. One of them was Dr. Martin Luther King. And when he talked about the need for racial reconciliation, not just based on politics, but based on the Bible and God's care for all people and God's call to reconciliation, you know, that I had never been taught that in church. That was a whole new way of seeing for me. And another one who played a big role, actually, in the thought that led to this book was a theologian named Walter Brueggemann. He's still alive and is a wonderful friend and mentor. And I remember Walter was the first person I ever heard who said, you know, a lot of people say the Bible has no contradictions. And then other people say the Bible has contradictions. And I never liked that argument. And Walter came along and said, no, the Bible doesn't have contradictions. The Bible has arguments. And you know, as soon as you realize, as soon as someone says that, you think, wow, that's really true. Like, you've already, let's see, have you come to the chapter about Abraham yet? Let me just see what chapter that is.
I think that's week after next, I think.
I think that'll be your next chapter. When you come to that chapter, you're going to see that there's an argument there about sacrifice and about what kind of sacrifices God wants. There are important, important arguments in the Bible, and we have different voices arguing about those things. And to me, that ability to see that this isn't a problem. This is how we learn in the Bible. We see key arguments, and then we see the truth come out of that argument. And then we see another argument, and then we see the truth come out of that argument. That, to me, is one of the key points of emergence. And as we move forward, it involves us not rejecting the Bible because, you know, for all the reasons that some people do, but not only reading it in the way that we used to, but respecting it and loving it in a fresh new way.
You know, Brian, we're a non-denominational church, and we'll be 20 year after next, I think. And one of the things we talk about all the time is that we really don't have to agree on all this, on everything. And living in the tension and still loving one another and serving together. And I think that's exactly kind of what you're hitting on there.
Well, you know, if we can see that even when you read the New Testament, there's some tension between what Paul says and what James says. But you realize, well, we're better off for that tension. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. And I'm sure in your congregation, you can look around and say, you know, he sees things a little differently than I do, but our church is a better church if both of us can bring our different perspectives and not always be fighting and not be vilifying each other. If we can actually love one another with our differences, that's a beautiful thing. And my goodness, I think we all need to see how in the world that needs to happen.
Who's next? Anybody? All right, Jim.
Hey, Brian, this is Jim again. That's a great answer. And what you just said took us into the question that I have. I just got finished teaching chapter one, and as I taught it Sunday in Sunday school class, as I researched it, this question came to me. You wrote that we learn that there are two essential truths about ourselves. We are good, all people are good, and we all bear God's images. No exceptions. That's your words. And I agree with that. We experience life through our relationships, and we experience love through our complementary differences, diversity. And you just used an example a minute ago of the generation me and you grew up in, of the issues of Dr. King, what Dr. King did from a racial reconciliation aspect. But the world we live in today is much different, with different religions of the Muslims and the Buddhists and all the different groups. Would you want to add to what you mean further by complementary differences?
Yes. Okay. What a great question. Boy, Jim, you got some good ones. Well, the first, let me just say, all of us, I think, are, as soon as you bring that up, Jim, we're thinking in the back of our minds about all that's going on with ISIS and these beheadings and bombings and all the rest. And one of the responses that often happens here in the United States is that people then say, all those Muslims are bad. The only time we ever hear about Muslims, they're bombing something or beheading somebody and so on. And it's easy when that's the only thing we hear for people to think, wow, all those Muslims must be like that. But of course, the truth is the only time people hear about Americans overseas is when they hear there was a record number of killings in Chicago, and American pastor burned a Quran, and there was rioting in Ferguson over race. You know, the only time we make the news over there is when something really bad happens too. And so one of the first things I think we need to realize when we think about differences between religions is how easy it is for us to, because of how the news works, for us to only get a part of the story. And that's on my mind because this afternoon, I just got an email of something that's very, very significant. For the first time, a lot of people don't realize that Muslims have different denominations just like Christians do. And so it's kind of like there are Protestants and Catholics. Well, there are Sunni and Shia, but they're all just like there are also Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and all the rest. There are a lot of other different sects in Islam. But among the Sunni, which is the largest group of Muslims, there are a lot of different divisions and sects as well. And just today, a group of one of the broadest groups of Sunni religious scholars and theologians got together and issued an open letter to this guy who's heading up ISIS, al-Baghdadi, I think is his name, or it's the name he calls himself. And they used the Quran to say, everything you're doing is wrong. Do not claim that you're doing this in the name of Islam. That's not right. It's against, you know, our religion. So you really, so I just bring up that story to say, let's try to remember that there, within every religion, there are people who are trying to get people to do the right thing, and there are other people who are inciting violence and fear and hatred and so on. So we just have to be careful about that. In terms of complementary differences, Gail mentioned earlier that idea that we all have spiritual gifts. And this is this beautiful image from the Bible that our differences are not matters of better or worse. They're matters of different opportunities for service. So my eyes serve my body in a different way than my ears. My ears serve in a different way than my mouth. And I think if we can have this idea that our greatest contribution is what we do for the larger whole, for the common good, then that helps us, I think, to understand both ourselves and others' differences in a better way. And so, I think that's a good thing. I'm not sure if that answered your question. Feel free to ask something else if I missed the point.
Hey, Brad, I just want to thank you for writing it, having the courage to write it, to explain it, to talk about it, because we understand in a generation when racial reconciliation happened, it's because there was communication. And that's how
exactly
we're going to solve this other problem. Thank you very much for what you do.
Thank you. Very well said, Jim.
Who else? Are we doing okay on time? Brian?
We're doing great for me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, what's your name?
My name is Moksha.
Hi, Moksha.
Hi. You voice so well just sort of the polarities and the whole spectrum in between when you're presenting different segments from the Bible and, you know, what that could even present, really and truly. And what you just talked about in terms of, you know, truly viewing the full spectrum in terms of what each religion can represent and, you know, what that adds to the greater whole is so well put. And what I'm curious about, actually, everything that I've read of yours so far, it just is a really, really beautiful way of stating what seems valid and totally true to me already. And I'm really curious if you've met a lot of resistance to what you actually put forward.
That's a good question, Moksha. Sure, I've met a lot of resistance for a lot of reasons. For example, when I say that we need to love and treat our Muslim neighbors with respect, some people get very upset about that. They think, hold it, it's us against them, you know. So that's understandable. I don't know how this went for you guys when you did chapter one. But, you know, when I just said in chapter one, look, I have no problem saying the earth is 13.7 billion years old. Some people say, no, the Bible says the earth is 6,004 years old or whatever. There are things like that people find some conflict about. And there are many very controversial issues. So some people don't like things that I say about different controversial issues. But I think even when people disagree, very often you can see that there really is something good in what they're saying. You know, there really is something good in their point of disagreement. I'll give you an example. you know, there's a big debate right now about gay people and homosexuality and how people respond to that. There's a debate in the culture. There's a debate in the church, debate about marriage and all the rest. Look, I don't want to get into that. And I'm sure we have different opinions on that in the room. But here's the thing. If 3 to 6% of people keep turning up gay, you know, we're going to have to deal with it. And some of the people who are very upset about my positions on this issue, they think you're undermining marriage, you're undermining the meaning of marriage. And as soon as they say that, I have to say, listen, you care about something that is really important. It's terrible. The reality of divorce is a terrible thing. It causes all kinds of pain and difficulty. We've got to help people have better marriages, start marriages better, and you know, continue marriages better, and deal with struggles in marriages better. We've got to help people do that. So very often we have people who are for something that's good. Each side is for something that's good. But in the process of being for something that's good, they might become against something that they shouldn't be against. Or the opposite. They might be against something that's worth being against, but in the process, they become for something that's not being for, worth being for. And so that's one of the things I try to do in those situations, is I try to find what's the good thing that they're for? What's the thing they're against that's worth being against? Let's start and rebuild. Let's start building from there. But it's not easy, and especially because I don't know what we're going to do about this, but right now, you know, our politics is so divided, and the way politicians win elections is by shaving off a few percentages from the other side. And there's a lot of people who win when the nation gets more and more divided. That's one of our big jobs, I think, as citizens, but also as Christians. If other people are always fracturing us, you know, who's going to be trying to bring us together? And I think that's a job of churches like yours and people like you. So, Moksha, thanks for asking that really good question.
All right. Anybody else? Who's next? Okay. Brian, you're about to meet the much better half of me.
Hello.
Hey, great. What's your name?
I'm Carla. I'm Josh's wife.
Hi.
Yeah, nice. He's probably to meet you, really Carla. Nervous about now that I've come up to the mic, but he'll be okay. My first question has to do, kind of piggyback on what you've been talking about. You know, Moksha asked if you were faced with opposition. We sometimes are faced with opposition too. And I'm just curious about what you do. I believe it's okay to have tension as well, but that we can still love each other. What do you do when people refuse to love? They just want to have the tension, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah. Well, hey, could I ask a question for you, Carla?
Yeah, sure.
Do you mean that? What do you do in a church? What do you do that in a friendship? What do you do in a family? Or do you just mean in general?
Friends and family.
Okay, great. So what you're really telling us is that you and Josh had a big fight, right? No, I'm just kidding. okay. One of the things that Jesus taught very, very clearly, and you're going to spend a whole 13 weeks in the Sermon on the Mount come next spring. So the group will grapple with this in a lot of detail. But one of the things Jesus talked about a lot in the Sermon on the Mount is reconciliation. He kept saying, he would say things like this. If you are in a dispute with someone, try to go and be reconciled with them. And he would basically put the responsibility on you, whether you're the person who was wronged or whether you're the person who did wrong. So the idea is that when there is a tension, instead of moving away, you try to move toward the other. And I'd say that's not always, there are sometimes you can't do that, but I think in general, you try to move toward the other, because when the tensions drive people away, I think it really becomes problematic and difficult. And other things that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, I think, are extremely helpful in this. He said, if someone strikes you on one side of the face, turn the other cheek. Now, a lot of people don't understand what that means, but think of it like this. If someone hurts you, you've got a couple options. You could say, you hurt me, bam, I'm going to hurt you back. That's one option. Another option, you could say, I'm going to run away and hide. Or another, you could, you know, get down on the ground. Please don't hurt me again. Please don't hurt me again. So you could respond with violence. You could respond with, you know, fear. Jesus says, look, if someone does something wrong, stand up and just keep speaking your truth. Stand up and keep trying to do the right thing. And so to me, that's, you know, that's really important. And what that would mean, and Jesus culminates that by saying, love your enemies. And that's the ultimate proactive thing when there's tension. Don't return evil for evil. Don't punch back. Don't run away. But just keep speaking your truth in a loving way. Move toward the other and keep loving your enemies. And it's interesting, the rationale he gives for that. He says, God makes the rain and sun fall on everybody, the evil and the good. In other words, there's this general graciousness that God just pours out on everybody. God pours that sun and rain out, not because they're good, but because God is good. And so I think if we're going to reflect or imitate God in that way, then the thing we want to learn to cultivate inside is, how can we be good to others, not because they're good, but because goodness is flowing out of us? Does that make sense, Carla?
You want to follow up? Do you want to follow up?
Yes, it makes sense. It's obviously not the easy thing to do, but we try. There's another question, and it's not mine. It's actually one of the guys from the sound booths. He texted me and asked me to ask this on his behalf. His name's Cody. He wants to know, does God's grace end at death?
Does God's grace, say it again?
Does God's grace end at death?
End at death. Well, you know, that really just builds on what I was saying to Carla, because if God is gracious because that's how God is, then I don't think God could stop being gracious in death. And this is just who God is. And to me, this is one of the most powerful and amazing things about Jesus, his message, and his death. I don't know if you know, you're going to get to this obviously next Good Friday, and that whole week you'll be dealing with this. But one of the truly amazing things when Jesus dies is that as he's being tortured and crucified, he says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. And I think, in that he's revealing the heart of God. I'm looking for the right word, that even at the point of death, God isn't saying, I'm going to get you guys back. I'm going to get revenge. That even at the point of death, God is radiating love. God is pouring out love. And that's what God is really like. If we believe that, I think that really changes everything for us. It certainly changes our own way of approaching God. We approach God realizing that God has nothing but grace for us. And I think it also changes the way that we approach other people. Cody, I can't see you, but I hope that's helpful in some way. But I think there's one other thing I should say. You know, because a lot of us were raised with this sort of zero-sum game, what everything is about is heaven or hell. One of the other things I think we've got to come to terms with that really is a strong theme in the Bible, that is that we are actually becoming something. You know, we're actually building character. And that character, I think, is it's forged through the way we live. Obviously, God sees us and loves us with grace, but we don't want to abuse that grace to say, oh, then I can do whatever I want, not because of God, but because what will we become if we don't take that grace seriously? So, you know, grace doesn't become an excuse to do what's wrong. In some ways, it removes us from the realm of fear and helps us then face the possibilities of what we want to become and what we can become. It's kind of an amazing thought that every one of us, you know, you sitting there, me sitting here, every one of us is in the process of becoming at this moment. And a week from today, we'll be a little more something, a little less something. Maybe we'll be a little more patient and a little less grumpy. Maybe we'll be a little more forgiving and a little less resentful. But we're all in this process of becoming. And I think that's a great way to understand grace. Grace creates the environment that just says, look, focus on what you can become. That's part, to me, a beautiful part of the good news.
Well, can I follow that up with just a thought or a question? Because you talk, you know, we talk about becoming. Obviously, the flip side of that is also possible. We could become less gracious, less generous, less loving as well. So we just finished this past Sunday talking about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and that issue of desire. I gotta tell you, I don't think I explained that near as well as you do. So could you just talk a little bit about that issue of desire and how that factors into this whole conversation?
Sure. Well, first let me say, you know, this is an interesting place where the Christian faith and Buddhism overlap, because both of our faiths and Judaism and every religion has something to say about this. But, you know, all religions, I guess we could say, have to talk about desire, because desire is what motivates us. I've got four little grandchildren, and they all go, you know, all of us who've raised children, you know, this stage, a baby, you know, when it's really small, it can't roll over. And it wants to roll over, and it can't roll over. And then the baby figures out how to roll over, and sometimes it rolls over by mistake. But, you know, it's frustrated when it wants to do something, and then it can't. Then it wants to learn how to crawl, and it doesn't know how to crawl yet. He or she doesn't know how to crawl, and they're frustrated. And then they learn how to crawl, and they are happy. And then they want to learn how to stand, and they can't do it yet, and they're frustrated. So desire is always related to frustration, and then leads to new breakthroughs. But here's the problem. Desire can also get us into a lot of trouble. If we desire what somebody else desires, then we become their rival, and we want to have what they have, and maybe we even want them to not have it so we can have it. And all kinds of trouble happens when two people desire the same thing, and we stop seeing one another as neighbors and start seeing each other as enemies. So desire can create a whole lot of problems. And in a way, those two trees represent the question, a choice of desire. One is and I know this is different than a lot of us have heard it, and if you don't agree with this, that's fine. Just try it on for size. If we desire the tree of life, and remember, trees are all about fruit, and fruit is all about desiring, right? If we desire the tree of life, we want aliveness. That will lead to one kind of life. But if what we want is to play God, remember, that's what the temptation was. Eat that fruit and you can be like a God. We want to play God, and we want to be able to judge who's good and who's evil, who lives and who dies. If we want power over other people and to play God in that way, we're not going to experience life. So, you know, to me, that's the best sense I can make of that choice and those two trees in the garden. Which do we desire? Do we desire life, aliveness, or do we desire to get into this business of playing God and accusing other people and calling other people evil, which then gives us the right to kill them and harm them and disrespect them and so on? And one reason I think that's a legitimate way of reading that text is because of what happens next. What happens next is two brothers ends up killing the other. And so their conflicting and competing desire ends up leading to violence. Isn't it interesting that so much of life is learning to face and manage our own desires? I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Anybody else? Oh, hold on. Dennis, let's let Gina go because she hasn't asked one yet.
Hi, Brian. I'm Gina Tynes, and I'm thankful for you writing the book, and it's certainly challenging me from my background, and I just have a question from you, and you'll probably get tickled when I ask you that. Obviously, all of us are sinners, and I'm certainly one of the greatest and thankful for the cross and Christ dying for us. And as we're going through these cultural changes and church challenges, I know all of us have sin. I guess my question is, we're thankful for God's grace and we're all evolving and coming into this aliveness that you're talking about. But at the same time, where do we find the balance of not compromising, loving yeah. people, but yet not leading them astray because we don't want to be offensive or judgmental? I don't want to be judgmental, but there are certain things that actually hurt God or he wouldn't have died for that. And that's what I struggle with.
Yeah. Your question is, how do we tell people that? How do we convey that to people?
I guess what's our responsibility, and maybe how do you think that's lovingly presented? Or obviously our lives are a testimony of ourselves, of the choices that we make. But sometimes, like I'm a mother of three children, sometimes I think we have to point out that they're so far in it, they don't realize the pain of what that's going to bring to their life today and days ahead. And I've personally experienced it myself. And so it's very dear to my heart.
Yeah. Your name again was?
My name is Gina.
Gina? Say it again.
You said it, Gina.
Gina. Okay, great. Thanks, Gina. Well, Gina, you're bringing up a really, really important question. I think it was in maybe the second chapter in the book where I talked about how, you know, we were given, in fact, let me just see if I can find the way I said it right near the beginning of the book. It's in the chapter, it's in the chapter called Being Human. It's a good and beautiful thing to be an image bearer of God, but it's also a big responsibility. We can use our intelligence to be creative and generous or to be selfish and destructive. We can use our physical strength to be creative and generous or to be selfish and destructive. We can use our sexuality to be creative and generous or to be selfish and destructive. We can use our work, our money, our time, our other assets one way or the other. And I think what that means for you as a mom is that you're looking at your children every day, trying to help them make the choice. You know, your child has a fist or has a hand. He can use it as a fist to clobber his, you know, little brother, or he can use it as, you know, a hand to reach out and reconcile with them. And all the time we're, as parents, we're trying to help our children learn to make those kinds of choices. And that's absolutely right. That's absolutely our responsibility with our children. And I think sometimes we just have to do it the way I'm sure you already do, Gina, and that's we just have to say, this is right and this is wrong. As the child gets older, I think we have to start giving the child reasons. Here's why I want you to, you know, not run out in the street. Here's why I want you to wear a bike helmet when you ride your bike. Here's why I want you to do this or that. We have to start giving them reasons. And we do that because when they become adults, they're going to have to figure out those reasons themselves. Then it gets to a new level of difficulty when we have to deal with adults. And then it's really, really tough. And I think when we're dealing with fellow adults, here's what we can say. you know, we can't order them around. And sometimes we try to bring God in and say, you know, God's going to get you. Some people that will work. Other people, you know, they'll just think that you're, you know, playing a game with them on that. But I think what we have to do with other people is we have to say, I'm concerned about something. I've noticed something. And here's why that worries me. And so that's what I think we have to do in those circumstances. You know, you have a friend who's drinking too much. I think part of being loving to that person is saying, I've noticed this and I'm really worried about it. And here's why. You know, that's different than saying, you need to stop drinking. When we do that, we're acting like a parent with a child. I think with a fellow adult, it's much better if we can say, I've noticed something and I'm concerned and here's why. We're acting like a peer to peer in that circumstance. I hope that's helpful in some way.
All right. Anybody else? Justin, then Rocky.
Hi, Brian. My name's Justin Wallace. My question for you is, do you think a lot of the reason why we envy and judge people is because they have a new car, a new phone, or other material things is because we aren't grateful for what God has given us and don't have gratitude to God for everything he gives to us?
Well, your first name again?
Justin.
Justin. Justin, a lot of wisdom there. And in fact, you've really hit on a couple of things that, you know, we've emphasized tonight. Gratitude means appreciating what we already have. And a lot of our conflicts come up because we want what somebody else has. In fact, in the New Testament, in the book of James, it says exactly that. It says, why do conflicts and wars arise among you? It's because of your desires. You want what somebody else has, and you're willing to steal or kill for it. So it's this problem of desire. And I'll tell you something that I think is really clear in the Bible, but that sometimes we don't notice it. It's that often our desires are stirred up by somebody else's desires. In other words, you know, you have two guys in school. One guy starts liking this girl. As soon as he likes her, now she seems more attractive to his best friend as well, you know, and you know where that's going to go. There's going to be trouble. So learning how to deal with our desire is one of the most important things. And learning to monitor our desire is one of the most important things. There's a verse in Proverbs that says it like this: guard your heart well, for from it flow the springs of life. And that, I think, is extremely, extremely wise. Your heart is where the desires come. And our aliveness is going to come from watching over our desires. It's a great reason to show up in church every Sunday. It's a time where you're going to slow down and say, what desires are really driving me right now? What desires are pushing me? And if just monitoring those it's going to help us a whole lot. And be suspicious, because if we can see, oh, that's a desire that could lead to this and this and this, that's going to get me in a lot of trouble. But, you know, the biblical word for that is self-examination. It's really, really an important thing.
All right, Rocky, and Brian, we'll make this our last question. We've kept you for about a little over an hour, so. And this is my father-in-law, by the way, so I really like him.
Hey, Rocky, good to meet you.
How are you?
Good.
My question is, what is your definition, or how would you explain prayer? Because I guess I don't see it like I once did. I would like to know what you think about it.
So could you say a little more about your thoughts on this?
Prayer. I want you to know. I want what you think about prayer. What's your definition?
He wants you to talk a little bit about what you think.
Oh.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. I once thought it was to change things, outcomes. I no longer think that. I don't think that's what it's for.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. It's really, Rocky, a really great question. You know, if I'm really honest about my experience of prayer, there have been times I've really wanted something or needed something and prayed for it, and it never happened. sometimes the opposite happened. There have been other times I really wanted something and I prayed for it and it happened and it felt like a miracle. And there have been other times great things happened and I never prayed for them. You know, so I have to face all of this, all these different experiences with prayer. And that leads me to really ask the same question you do. What's it really for? Is prayer really about getting God to do our will on earth? And that's why the Lord's Prayer is so interesting. The Lord's Prayer is, may your kingdom come, may your will be done on earth. So interestingly, for Jesus, the primary prayer of the Lord's Prayer is not how can we get things to go our way, but it's aligning our wills with God's will. It's syncing up our desires with God's desire. So if you think about, and this brings us back to the last question, this brings us back to this issue of desire. You could say that prayer in many ways is desire management. It's our way of keeping track of our desires in God's presence. And that's a big thing. Now, I keep praying. If I'm in trouble, I pray. But, you know, I've become a little suspicious about seeing prayer as God getting me out of trouble. If I can say it like this, if I don't do my homework, if I'm in school and I don't do my homework, and the next day I get up and pray, God, I didn't do my homework, help me get an A on the test anyway, and God answers my prayer. And then the next day, I don't do my homework, and I pray, and I get an A. And the next day, I don't do my homework. In a funny way, by God answering my prayers, he's turning me into a lazy student. And he's turning me into he's helping me be a stupid person who doesn't really learn anything. And we know that that's not what God wants. So that's why I like to think of prayer more in terms of aligning our desires with God's desires and opening our hearts to God and bringing everything in our lives to God and not keeping it a secret to ourselves and a secret to God, but just opening it to God. I'm not trying to give you another book to read, Rocky, because you've got enough already. But a few years ago, I was struggling with the same question, and I wrote a book called Naked Spirituality. The subtitle is A Life with God in 12 Simple Words. And that book, I tried to take these questions about prayer and say, what is prayer really about? And I'll tell you the 12 words, they might be useful for you. And obviously the book could be helpful for you too. But the first word is here, H-E-R-E. That's just the prayer of saying, here I am, God. I'm aware of you. I know you love me. I love you. It's sort of like checking in with God. I'm here. A little bit like the teacher calls out the role and you say here, and it's your way of saying, God, I'm here. Second is the word thanks. We've talked about gratitude a couple times tonight. Third is the word oh. I use that as like the word of wow or hallelujah. It's the word oh. It's the word of worship. Fourth is the word sorry. That's the word for acknowledging to God our mistakes and errors. Fifth is the word help. That's when we acknowledge our own weakness and our need for more strength or wisdom or whatever. Next is the word please. That's where we pray for other people. We feel compassion for them and we bring their pain to God and we share their pain with God. And in some ways, we join our concern for them with God's concern for them. Then come three more words that are really difficult. The word when or how long. That's when we're in pain and we're saying, how long is this going to last, God? Next is the word no, where we just say, this is crazy. I can't deal with this anymore. I can't accept that this is the way things are supposed to be. Then is the word why. That's where we just say, I don't know what's going on. And some of us have been in those difficult times in life where there's a lot of when, no, and how long, or, and why. The last three words are behold. That's my word for just opening up and seeing. Wow, it's just opening and seeing what God is doing. And then is the word yes. That's the word of surrender and yielding to God. And then finally is no word at all. It's just learning to be with God and God's presence and silence and trust and rest and confidence. Now, I gave you a lot more than you asked for there, but basically, Rocky, I think anybody who's in need should call out to God and pray. But I think you're saying, what's the real purpose of prayer? Is it to help me get A's on my test when I didn't study. Absolutely not. Something deeper is going on that has to do with our maturity and development as whole people experiencing aliveness.
Brian, thank you so much. Thank you for being with us tonight. Thank you for your work over these last 10, 15 years that has shaped me and countless others. And it's shaping our church in many ways as well. So we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. And can we give Brian a hand?
Thank you. Thank you.
And maybe we could Skype you in for a sermon sometime if we can't get you here in person.
This did pretty well. I've never been there, but I already feel like I love your congregation, and I know where I'd go to church if I lived in your neighborhood. A pleasure to be with you guys. Keep up the good work, and thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks, Brian. Take care.